Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo Podcast Edition. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
Hi.
John Lindemann.
Always a pleasure, Johnny.
And returning to the show, Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
John, you sound congested.
I am congested. I still have PAX flu. I'm getting over it.
Oh, no.
Yep. Yeah, I got sick on Sunday, and it just carried over. I took a day off work, the whole nine yards.
So. Oh, man. I wish I could have taken a day off work. I went to work Monday, and I was in shitty condition. I was a wreck. Those cute kitties in your apartment, John, they did a number on me.
Yeah, I can believe it. I can believe it. There's plenty of cat hair in this apartment, you know?
But not on your head.
So, we are obviously home from Boston and from the PAX East convention. I thought the panel was super fun, went really well. There had some audio issues in the recording, but, you know, we're doing what we can about that. And as of this recording, actually, for this episode, the video just went up. So you can actually watch the entire panel in video form. Jared put it up. If you go to the podcast article, the video is embedded there and you can watch the whole thing. So, and the audio might actually sound a little better on that. So check it out. That is really cool that he was able to do that, and we thank Jared very much for it. Also, of course, want to thank Guillaume again, our special guest. Thought he did a really nice job, and it was fun to hang out with him all weekend at PAX East. Him and the Negative World people had a really good time, played some Smash Brothers with him. So, of course, we're back now in the regular format, and that means we have Greg here. We are going to return to the topic of PAX East in a little bit, and we didn't record any special shows. The kind of situation didn't really lend itself to that. So there are no drunk casts or reports from the show floor or anything like that. It didn't really make sense at the time, but there are a number of topics I think are worth revisiting from PAX East that we haven't yet talked about on the show. So we'll do that in a little bit, but I want to kick it off with some new business from you because it's been 2 weeks since we heard from you.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm sure the absence of any kind of, drunk cast, either public or private, reinforces Carl's sense of purpose in life.
Yes.
That he wasn't there.
We desperately need him next year.
Well, over the last couple of weeks, I finished off Kid Icarus, kind of picking up from my last new business. I was really close to the end a couple of weeks ago, so I just finished that off, and I've played it a bit more, doing stuff on higher difficulties. I've got most things are done now on like 7 or higher. Mm. But once you kind of get better equipment, it does balance out a fair bit. So I've been enjoying that still.
Are you messing with the internet play?
I still haven't got around to that very much. Unlike something like Mario Kart and DOA, I haven't got a friend who's also got a copy of that. So, I haven't been able to sort of play it locally.
Oh, but, right.
I am waiting on Rhythm Thief. I pre-ordered it a bit before it came out in Europe last week, but it has not showed up yet. So not able to talk. Hopefully I'll be able to go into detail on that next week, although in terms of it coming out of the States, I understand it still doesn't have a solid date, and I guess people have been worried because of the Sega situation. Yeah. They've been firing people in the Western offices, and basically this trip, if it ain't Sonic and Aliens, it's in trouble. It's kind of scary. But
they do have one other game, but I'm going to talk about that in a little while.
Sure, but I think the indications are that Rhythm Thief will still get published in North America at some point. I think that's probably far enough along that it's going to escape this cull of, original IP that's coming at Sega. But Nintendo is handling the distribution here and stuff. I haven't exactly been blown away by the level of publicity that they've managed to engender for it, and I think it sort of passed without a trace on the charts and stuff. But it's got good reviews and everything, so I'm really looking forward to that. But what I've been playing for quite a while now, as I mentioned getting it some weeks ago, is Cave Story 3D. And obviously Cave Story, especially in North America, where it's been out on each individual platform for a lot longer, and that's leaving aside the whole PC freeware situation, is a very known quantity, so I won't take too long with it. But for my part, this was the first time that I've played Cave Story at all. So I'd been looking forward to it. I'd always wanted to get it sort of in the right setting. But I must say, having seen them now, you know, played them directly, I am very pleased with how the game looks. I think it's got a very, very nice use of the stereoscopic effect and things. And the main reason that I like it so much, I mean, first of all, you've got the lighting and the atmospherics, which on the one hand, I guess maybe it does make the game a bit less dark and bright as it probably was, you know, in its original form. Although, again, you know, I haven't played that, so you have to bear that in mind.
Well, consider the 2D version doesn't actually have lighting. They can cast colors around, but you're not going to get that kind of atmospheric sense from it.
Yeah, and because you've got a situation where, you know, you're in these kind of subterranean environments and all that, I think it does lend a really nice ambience to a lot of the locations. The one thing, though, that really caught my eye was something that actually reminded me of going back to the Shinobi for 3DS, which is not nearly so attractive, despite being sort of fundamentally similar in that, you know, it's a side-scrolling game, but with polygonal graphics and the stereoscopic effect. But there was one part in Shinobi that really struck me. It was right at the end, where you're in, like, this sort of crazy alien ship, and you get to a part where there's, like, a hangar in the background. And it just seems huge because the depth effect goes so much farther back, or it seems to go so much farther back than anything else in the rest of the game. It's like I'm in a big place now, you know, and that is something that the stereoscopic effect can actually really bring to a side-scrolling game, is that sense of scale.
Right.
And while that was kind of isolated in Shinobi, I really didn't have that feeling very often in that, apart from what I just described, in Cave Story, it's happening a lot. So, you know, you're kind of shifting from, like, intimate little settings, you're inside, like, with some of the characters' houses or whatever, and some of the smaller areas, to then, you know, in the sand zone or something where you've got, like, ruins extending way into the background, all these different kind of layers of details, or, like, even fairly early on, you've got the graveyard, and there's like a little lonely sort of house or something that seems way in the distance, all that kind of stuff.
Right. So I had that same experience even just playing a short demo of it at E3 last year. I think the graveyard in particular, because that's early in the game, and it was one of the places I was able to get to in the demo. And I was like, wow, I mean, it's really quite distracting for me, especially, you know, I'm running all these sort of comparative analyses because I know what the game looks like in 2D. And, I was really only looking at the graphics because I knew what the game played like. And I was like, wow, that looks crazy, you know, and I was wondering if it would bother me playing the game. I thought it looked great, but almost too great, like almost too flashy and too open and too deep, because it in terms of gameplay, it is very, very, very strictly 2D, and yet the game looks so 3D that I was wondering if I'd be able to handle it. And then, you know, another game I was just thinking of as you described this effect is Shadow Complex on the 360. And it pulls off a very similar thing, and it, you know, it really has to do with the environment design and the graphics style, and it does it without 3D. I'm sure the stereoscopic enhances it, but it's a kind of effect that really is sort of limited to 2.5D platforming style games, of which there just aren't all that many. And, you know, if you look at like Nintendo's own efforts in this realm, like, you know, New Super Mario Brothers, they really aren't going for that very much at all.
Well, they're not, but I would say DKC Returns has got quite a lot more going on, and it does actually manage to get a sense of spectacle. And that's why, certainly, you know, if they ever want to do a sequel to that on 3DS, you know, that would come across even more so, being enhanced by the stereoscopic effect. But yeah, that's the difference. You know, with like sprite-based games, you could still do a little bit of that with Parallax. And then, I mean, if you look at like stuff like Symphony of the Night, they actually introduced a few like choice polygonal elements to try and get that effect. Like there's that chapel bit, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which has like polygonal elements, or the clock tower in the background is polygonal as you go to Dracula's Keep and stuff. So, you know, sometimes even a sprite-based game can use the occasional bit of geometry like that to try and achieve the effect. But here in Cave Story 3D, it's just completely consistent. And after after a while, yeah, it's kind of flashy and all that. And maybe this is helped by the fact that I am not familiar with the original form. But after a while, you just get used to it and you play it. And I didn't find it distracting. I just found, you know, it lent to the game's atmosphere a great deal. And so that was all wonderful. In terms of playing the game itself, I was expecting it to be the kind of game I'd enjoy. And certainly it has been. I'm currently nearing the end of my third playthrough of the game. I mean, it's not very long, and I've had quite a while to get to that point. But of course, it has all these sort of choices. Some of them are more explicit than others, to say the least.
Yes.
In terms of how you might come across different parts of the game, or the ending might end up different, this kind of thing. But the biggest thing for me, the biggest fork in the road, is kind of the whole thing of the machine gun and its famous ability that the kickback kind of makes you hover. Which, the first time I was playing, as soon as I got the chance to take that weapon, I wanted to, because everyone goes on about that power being cool, and it is cool. But what's interesting is there is the opportunity to forego that, which I did, you know, in another playthrough. And it does throw a different light on, you realize how kind of carefully the levels were designed.
Yes.
So that, you know, you would still navigate them without that hover ability, but it would be a very different experience. It's a lot more careful. And then ultimately there are kind of rewards associated with not having that kind of crutch available to yourself as soon as you might do. But I think what it really showed to me is how deliberate and well constructed the levels are compared to something like Castlevania, you know, Metroidvanias. Because very often, you know, there's at least parts of them are just kind of spaces with a few brainless enemies in, and you kind of saunter through them.
Long hallways full of zombies.
Yeah, hallways, yeah. The open, aimless real estate. With this, it's much more, even, I mean, it's not like interconnected to the level of something like a Super Metroid. You know, it's a bit more of a traditional action game than that. But still, it's really impressive to the extent that you are, you know, retraversing things with new powers or stuff, that you have this level design that's so purposeful. This school of level design is right up my alley. I think it's fantastic. So I've had a wonderful time with Cave Story 3D, and this last portion of it is incredibly difficult.
Oh, are you in the ultimate dungeon or whatever?
Yeah, basically. They call it hell. That's what
it pretty much is. Yeah.
That's where they start designing the levels around the advanced power that you have to kind of jet around the level in all four directions, all this stuff. So they don't have to worry anymore about, well, if you've got this or that, you know, it's just all out and it's really, really difficult.
Yeah. I, you know, as a lover of jetpacks and video games, I should adore that level. I just respect it, because if that level had no combat and it was all platforming and I could really focus on that, I could probably get into it enough to finally make it through and I'd feel really satisfied. But it's the mixing of the incredibly precise jetpack platforming with lots of instant death everywhere and tons of very yeah. punitive combat where you can very easily lose the weapons that you know you're going to need when you get to the end of this thing. And it's just a dreadful combination of obstacles that the game well, throws at you.
I mean,
you
they are maxing it out at that point, aren't they? I mean, I played three times. So first time, I just kind of played it without knowing anything. Second time, there were some obvious sort of forks in the road that I thought, well, I'll do that differently. And then the third time, I was like, okay, let's look some stuff up now.
Right.
So I can actually, you know, find some. And so very easy, you play games twice and you wouldn't see some of this stuff. So it's definitely for the people that want it, that's really see everything kind of people. But I will say, for the combat in general, that whole weapon powering system and losing the energy when you get hit, I think it's quite an elegant way of approaching the kind of problem that you get with this style of game, where if you have powered up, you know, in terms of increasing your health, that you could just kind of aimlessly kind of brute force your way through lesser enemies and
sure.
stuff.
It solves the screw attack problem.
You still have to be careful, because while you might well be able to absorb the hits without being really close to death, it will impede your ability to actually kill stuff, and it can become quite a precipitous slide, you know, how much more difficult it is to get through something if your weapons kind of go, yeah, because they are a lot more powerful when you've got the full energy for them. So I think it's really clever. I mean, that's the thing. The whole thing is just, there's so much thought that's gone into it, which is, you know, very impressive. But being as it is a labor of love, I mean, perhaps shouldn't be surprising, but it's still pulled off with such skill.
Yeah, and Nicholas is always kind of teasing that Pixel would like to make a sequel to Cave Story, and that would be pretty cool because it's been remade multiple times. Even the WiiWare version is a remake. And they've, you know, obviously it's a great game to begin with, and they've kind of milked it and polished it and gone back to it and added more content. I'm not downplaying the level of effort that all that required, but I don't think, I mean, and this guy has a couple other sort of smaller, less well-known, less ambitious games that he's done for a computer, but I don't think he's made really a brand new game in a long time. And, you know, if he is going to end up making it by himself, we can probably keep waiting much longer. I'm kind of hoping that he'll have a team this time from the start that he can really direct and make sure that his vision is created, but done so in a more efficient way. But I don't know. I don't know. I'd love to see more Cave Story. If he wants to do something different, I'd be down for that too. But Cave Story is a game that's very easy to fall in love with. Okay, John, I know you played a little bit of Xenoblade this week, but not very much at all.
Yeah, not very much at all. Just, I mean, the opening part is kind of what I played through. My goal was to just get it to a point where I could save my game and, you know, get through the intro, because, you know, all JRPGs have an intro that is often incredibly overblown and dramatic and...
Check.
So, yeah, I gotta say, the opening intro, kind of cringeworthy in some respects. You know, a lot of cheesy back and forth between the characters. What really surprised me was that they didn't even bother trying to sync anybody's lips at all. Like, there was no lip syncing whatsoever. It was pretty obvious that it was going strictly to the Japanese vocal track. But it's certainly a great-looking game. I think the combat will take some getting used to. They definitely throw a lot at you right off the bat. Like, there's a lot of tutorial pages to go through. You know, but just having to... It's kind of a weird mix of having to manually target something and then kind of letting the combat do its thing.
Yeah, it's semi-passive.
Yeah, it just seems kind of strange. Like, I would think it would either be one or the other.
Yeah, I felt the same way as you when I first played the game, you know, several months ago. I was like, man, there's so many systems. They're so confusing. The whole thing is so complicated. And yet during the battles, it feels like I'm not really doing that much. It feels like it's kind of just playing out. And I think once you get deeper in the game, as I am a little bit now, I've been playing it this week, and I had a similar experience to you, John, where, you know, I booted up, I had, I don't know, 6.5 hours on it probably from when I was playing it earlier, booted up after months, and had no idea what was going on in the story, where I was supposed to be headed, and couldn't remember how anything worked, you know, and all these complicated systems. And so it was really kind of like a quick relearning process, but I got back into it pretty fast. And I've noticed that now, as I'm, you know, like 8 or 9 hours into it now, as your characters build up, you will take a more active role in the battles, and you will understand what's going on in there better. And it will feel a lot less passive as you go forward in the game.
Yeah, the biggest part where your agency is coming in here in terms of battle is you've got the arts, you know, the special moves, and, you know, some of those have, like, you know, very specific kind of locational things. So it's like, okay, well, if you do this and you're actually attacking the enemy from the side, it will have a status effect on them that it otherwise wouldn't have. Or if you perform this art from the back, it'll inflict more damage than it otherwise would. So you do have to think about moving the character and all that kind of thing with those sorts of effects. So I found the level of involvement quite satisfactory overall.
A lot of times it comes down to setting up these chains that you can build, and you'll get into this a little bit later, John.
Yeah, I mean, I've fought one battle.
Yeah, I think they actually show you a chain in that battle, and then they take it away from you for a while. And then
that's like a preview, the opening.
So later in the game, as you can run through fields, you can basically just build up a large number of enemies fighting you. And the advantage of that is you get more, essentially, rewards for the more that you're fighting at one time. And if you've got a ton of enemies sort of stacked in the battle, it can become incredibly just messy.
And that's where, you know, stuff like the aggro concepts could come into play. You know, if you've got right. somebody in your party that draws the fire of all those guys, then you could be the one that's actually inflicting all these status affecting moves from those specific areas because they're not just surrounding you and all that. So, you know, it's a satisfactory strategic component to it as well.
Also, eventually you're going to get to the forging section, which will give you the best localization I've ever heard. did you ever actually do any forging, Greg?
A little bit. I mean, they're not really that important, but they give you a little stat buff, so it's kind of...
I've found boss battles where, like, going back and forging gem has made all the difference in the world, and then the warp system meant that I could just do it without punishment.
Well, it's that, or it's almost any system you choose. I mean, I found that I'll get to a boss, get my ass kicked, step outside, shuffle around some equipment and fight maybe three battles to gain a little bit extra experience, go back in there and get a completely different result. And I think that's very admirable because, you know, the whole concept of grinding in RPGs comes from the fact that it takes a long time and a lot of effort put into your character building in order to get a result out of it. And it just becomes kind of laborious. And the weird thing in Xenoblade that I found is that it feels like, you know, if you'll just take just the minimal amount of time to look at your characters and thoughtfully do whatever you need to do to develop them, whether it's, you know, do some skill links, change out some equipment, change out some gems, get even one level up, which usually doesn't take very long at all, it makes a huge difference in combat. Just immediately you can feel it. You can see it right away. And that is refreshing, and it means that, you know, it's okay. You start to get comfortable with the idea that you don't always have to be totally successful in battle. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't mean, oh shit, now I've got to look forward to 2 hours of running around fighting slimes over and over again. It's not that at all.
Right up until the end of the game, at which point you're going to be mining all of the systems to try to get a different outcome in that boss battle.
I mean, it's certainly a good-looking game so far. I mean, right off the bat, they kind of... the camera work of the intro, you know, where they kind of pan out and scan the entire world of this whole, like, the body of this gigantic monster.
Yeah.
You know, they definitely right away, they try to, you know, set it up like this is a huge world that you have to explore. So they really emphasize that in the intro.
The game is replete with establishing shots.
Yes.
Pretty much at any point you find somewhere new, you're going to get an establishing shot of it.
That's what you would want. I mean, it's a game that you can criticize the graphics a lot if you're looking at some up-close cutscene in, you know, some kind of interior room where the characters are talking, and sometimes their mouths just don't even move at all in some of the more minor cutscenes, and the characters' faces are not detailed, and their bodies are not detailed, and the textures aren't great when you get up really close to them, but that's not really the point. And that, you know, that's not really what the game is about. The game is about these huge vistas and gigantic environments. And anytime you're out in one of those places, it looks incredible.
Yep.
You know, and that's a choice that they made to focus on that aspect of the game. I think it was the right choice because not enough games do that.
In fact, it's difficult for them to put too much detail on the characters because their character models change based on what they're wearing.
Yeah, which I do actually really like. I love messing around with equipment and finding that your character comes out looking totally different.
And some of the outfits they end up with, depending on who's wearing what, you're like, wait, what? How did that turn into this?
I've heard about the bikini armor suits and stuff like that.
Yeah, those are absurd and a mute. Like, it's like heavy armor, and yet all that's covered are her boobs. This game gets weird.
It's already weird right from the intro.
It gets weirder.
You're on the top of a big monster, and people are talking like Australians. It's kind of weird.
The voice acting is funny because I was very much like you, John, in the first hour. I mean, that first hour is mostly cutscenes, and it's a little intense. And I was thinking, man, I'm not a fan of these voice actors. But it settles down pretty quickly after that, and you get to spend a lot more time with a smaller number of characters. And they really do start to kind of, you know, build up a lot of personality, and the voices start to feel like they actually fit the characters a lot better, and they become less annoying over time.
So there's a female character you meet later who, like, at first, when I first met her, I was like, God, she's obnoxious. And then at some point, I'm like, okay, I can deal with her. And at some point, I'm like, she might have the best voice acting skills in this game. Of course, I then later found out she's actually, like, professional television actor, so it's like, oh, okay. There's really only like one or two characters in the game whose voice actor really should be just banned from doing anything ever again. And to the defense of the guy who did Ryan's voice acting, he does have dialogue like, "It's Ryan time," written for him, so it's not his fault entirely.
Yeah, I was going to say, after spending several hours with Ryan, I think he's probably my favorite voice actor.
It's one of my pet peeves. It's the random babble stuff.
His is the worst.
It really is a separate issue, but of course it bleeds over. Because if you just get sick of the sound of someone's voice, it then affects the proper dialogue scenes rather than just the canned things that come out when you're fighting and stuff. So I dislike that practice in general in games. And this
eat my bullets.
Yeah. But this is a pretty severe
never forget
offender in that character.
And most of the offenses are from Ryan.
But you don't, there comes a time when he doesn't have to be in your party.
There does, yeah. But I mean, he is really effective, so you're like, kind of want to leave him in here, but God, he talks a lot.
All right, well, that's Xenoblade. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it, because a lot of our listeners are playing it this week for the first time. And I'm, like I said, I'm going back to it finally now that I finished Mass Effect 3, and I'm enjoying it so far. I'm actually excited to keep playing it, so glad to be finally back into that. All right, so James didn't really have anything new this week, so I'll finish up new business with a couple of quick games before we get into our PAX talk, because on the plane, primarily to and from PAX, I started playing Tales of the Abyss finally. I've had it for several weeks, but I hadn't had a chance to really get into it yet. And, this was highly recommended by some of our staff members, and I was, knowing that this was a PS2 game that a lot of people revered as the best Tales game, and one of the best Japanese RPGs of the past several years, and a game that got really not a fair shake in the West. I think they released it in very small quantities and got no attention whatsoever. It was really kind of obscure on the PlayStation 2. I was really excited that they're bringing this to 3DS. I'm excited to have an RPG to play on my 3DS. That's always kind of a big moment when the first big, great RPG comes out for a platform and you can really sink your teeth into it. So I was excited to check this out. And I do really like it so far. I've put only a few hours into it. I'm still early, especially for a game like this. But it seems to be really... Well, it has really nice production values, so the graphics are great. The 3D effect is better than I expected for a conversion from PlayStation 2. I think they have done a few things in staging some of the cutscenes and moving the camera around that is meant to accentuate the 3D. So it ends up feeling like a lot of the time when you're playing the game, the 3D is very subtle and really doesn't stick out very much. But then there are always these moments in cutscenes or certain things happen that really look 3D. So it's a little inconsistent maybe, but I do think they put some effort into trying to sort of upconvert it to 3D. And otherwise, it's not like a movie where you have to wear the glasses the whole time, even when the 3D is meaningless. At least for 3DS, it's really not impeding you at all, even when the 3D is sort of in mild. So I think it works fine, and the game certainly looks great. It sounds really good. The music is great. The voice acting, I'm not really a fan of, but it's mainly because it's clear that they kind of went to their stock anime localization troupe, and I actually recognize some of the voices. I've heard them in TV shows and, anime movies and other video games. And
I'm sure the Black Power Rangers in there.
Yeah, well, if you've played Tales of Symphonia, which is the only other Tales game I've played, and that was, like 8 years ago or something. It's been a long time.
Something like that, yeah.
The level of voice acting is exactly the same. And in fact, probably a lot of the actors are exactly the same. So if you're okay with that, you'll be fine with it. It's a little bit of a pet peeve for me because it is very much done up in an anime fashion, which I think is fairly played out in Japanese RPGs. I'd prefer they did something different. I think Xenoblade, if nothing else, has a unique style to its voice production.
Well, I mean, but that's the Tales series, though. They've always done that.
I guess so. I mean, yeah, you could maybe argue this is just a characteristic of the franchise that I'm not as familiar with. But, the voice acting is pretty annoying in a lot of cases. But what I do like a lot is that a huge part of the game is voice acted. Virtually all the dialogue in the game. And there's a lot of dialogue. It's a Japanese RPG. So that is really surprising. I mean, it would have been really nice on the PS2, but on the 3DS on a handheld, it's kind of shocking to see this level of production value. And, they they kind of carried it over from a previous version of the game, but still, it's pretty amazing. And unlike Ocarina of Time or Star Fox 3D, this is a port from a game that I never played before and most people never played before. So it feels new, even though it's technically a few years old. Otherwise, it seems to be a fairly typical Tales game in the sense that the combat is, you know, the side view action game where you're kind of just running back and forth, jumping up and down and smacking your sword. And it's all very responsive to your input. So there's no menus during combat, that none that I've seen so far. And it's very fast paced. The battles are really quick to play out and they're repetitive. Yes, mainly because the enemies so far in the game are not very difficult. But, you know, you can't really knock an RPG for having repetitive battles. I mean, I think these are no more repetitive than in other games. They're probably less so. And they're certainly engaging and fun to do. So I enjoy that stuff. The world seems to be colorful and very pretty and interesting to look at and with a lot of cool places to go. I will say the story is fucking incomprehensible so far.
Well, again, it's a Tales game. Those go together.
Yeah,
I mean, keep in mind, Tales of Symphonia was about the human ranches. And then by the end of it, it turned into, oh, and also you're a god.
That's awesome.
And then the sequel to that game said, oh yeah, we lied about the whole first game. That shit's all made up. if you played the first both Tales of Symphonia games back to back, your head would explode.
This game really throws you into like very complicated political systems, you know, warring kingdoms, weird magical cults and like holy orders of knights who protect those cults and sacred beasts and just a bunch of fucking bizarre shit.
John Lindemann's a sacred beast.
Absolutely.
Was that a dog?
That's a sacred roar.
It's a sacred roar! No wonder you needed an army to protect you.
If you've ever seen those photos of the guy doing Wolf Link cosplay, now we know it was John inside the suit the whole time.
Never. It lies. Lies.
They get away kinda with this with a, you know, a very typical anime story conceit that your main character, who is your avatar, really knows nothing about the outside world. So everyone has to explain everything to him, but he also tends to kind of like to play up the idea that he's not actually as ignorant as he really is. So he's always pretending to know more than he really does about what's going on. And so a lot of times the other characters will just keep talking, you know, and they won't stop to explain things to him. And then I get really lost. He also, of course, has amnesia, but not up-to-date amnesia. He doesn't remember his childhood. So now he's a teenager. Something happened in his childhood and everything before that point, he can't remember.
Up-to-date amnesia.
Yes.
His amnesia needs to be renewed.
He remembers, it's like he had amnesia and then 5 years later is when the story starts, you know, so he remembers all of recent history. Why is this relevant? I don't know.
I'm sure he's like the descendant of a god or something.
Yes, yes. He had some bizarre conception or birth or something.
Just wait it out. He was born that age or something. Just wait.
Yeah. Well, apparently he has resonance with the seventh phonon.
Good. Not a fan of the seventh phonon, but I understand its value.
Well, this has to do with a certain method of interacting with the phone
dialing,
which is like some kind of blanket of mystical energy that surrounds the planet and enters through certain locations. It is, dude, the mythology they've built up here. It's like the more layers they peel back, the more desperately befuddled I become. So,
how far are you into this game in terms of hours?
Like 4 or 5 hours, maybe. I am completely blown away by the complexity and strangeness of what's going on in the story. And I mean, it's not bothering me. I'm just kind of laughing at it. I'm like, really? Like, the more bizarre terms and constructs they throw in there, the more I like it, because it's obvious that they're not going to stop and explain this stuff to me. They're just going to keep going.
There's a point in the Symphonia sequel where they just announce, yeah, those gods you saw in the last game, aliens. And it's like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's go.
Sure.
I'm ready.
Of course they're aliens.
I'm ready for this.
Why was I thinking otherwise?
So it's a crazy, crazy game, and I'm enjoying it so far. I mean, it'll take me a long time to get through it, but, it, you know, having it on the portable is very nice, and it means that I can maybe keep playing other RPGs on the console and not completely go mental, you know, and not just totally lose it. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it. And the other game I wanted to talk about for new business this week is Metal Torrent. This is a totally different change of topic. This is a vertical shoot 'em up game that is on DSiWare, and I got it for free through Club Nintendo. I don't know if it's still available by the time you hear this. It may not be, but it was very cheap. I think it was like 100 coins or something. It's like one of the more easy to get Club Nintendo games, and it's... Let's just say the price I paid, which is $0 technically, is pretty commensurate with the amount of content here. And, you know, I mean, shoot 'em ups have this reputation for being incredibly short, but this one really takes the cake. So it has two modes. It has easy mode and insane mode. There's nothing in between.
It's like Alien Soldier, super easy, super hard.
Yeah. And from what I've played, they're very aptly named. The easy mode is pathetic. I did not die. I beat the game in one sitting, did not die the first time I ever played it. Yeah. And the entire game takes about 15 minutes to go through.
Oh, dear Lord.
It's starting to sound like, was it Star Soldier R, which was just a score attack for WiiWare.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Right.
Yes. Yep, I remember that.
Basically one level.
So, who is the developer for this?
I'm not really sure. It was published by Nintendo for DSiWare. Maybe Eureka? It is fun to play. I'll say that. It looks pretty good, and it's definitely fun to play. It's just insanely short, and the easy mode is beyond easy. It is like basically hold the button down. There were times I saw bullets pass directly over my hitbox and I did not die. Didn't even take damage because you can get hit several times and it recharges if you don't get hit for several seconds.
Wow.
So it is almost impossible to die.
It's pretty much just like one of those cheat modes, you know, where you can't die.
it's a built-in god mode. And then I went to insane and that was much more of a typical shoot 'em up experience. I mean, I was able to play for several minutes, but I certainly didn't beat the game and I definitely was losing lives and eventually lost all of them. So that's much more of a real, shoot 'em up game. Of course, it's not going to be any longer, but you're not as likely to actually get through the whole thing in one sitting. So, Metal Torrent, I don't know what the original price was. If it was
500,
if it's $5 and you really like shoot 'em ups, it's probably worth that.
And you're right. It is Eureka.
Eureka. Okay. It's a neat little game. It's nothing super memorable or super special, but, it's worth checking out. And if you can still find it on Club Nintendo, I'd say, hell, go for it. You know, if you like shoot 'em up games, it's a neat little thing that you'll play around with and say, okay, well, $5. Hey, pretty good deal. All right. So why don't we jump into some PAX tales of the PAX? Because we got into a lot of weird, weird stuff and had a lot of strange experiences at PAX East. And I know James and John are chomping at the bit to talk about 3DO. So let me open the gates and unleash the Kraken.
The Kraken is in your mind.
Now, originally, James and I we were not set to have an encounter with the 3DO.
No, we were originally going after E.T. for the Atari 5600.
Or 7800, I think.
Yeah, but I was standing in line, which was very, very long in the Classic Gaming Room that day. It was exceptionally long.
It was kind of long the whole time because they were, I think, really poorly managing the checkout system. And then their computer got stolen and they just stopped checking out games at all on the last day.
Their shit got jacked. But this was the worst it was in any of the times I saw. This was Friday night.
Yep.
So John and Carly are over there enjoying the beanbag while I'm standing in line.
Slave.
At some point, I changed my mind and said, whoa, is that a 3DO? Oh, God.
Well, and note that nobody was ever on it.
No,
right?
it was just empty. And I was like, it was just sitting there, and the line happened to snake past the 3DO console. I'm like,
unloved.
That's a 3DO right there. And then I grabbed, as the line slowly inched forward, I grabbed the document that had all the games on it. And I just flipped through the 3DO, and something jumped out at me. And I said, well, this has to happen. John, do you remember what that something was?
Was that Way of the Warrior?
That was Way of the Warrior.
I missed this. I'm so sorry that I wasn't
there. Oh, Lord.
So I just saw the phrase Way of the Warrior and thought, well, that can't possibly be good.
Yeah.
I was entirely correct. So Way of the Warrior is sort of a Mortal Kombat ripoff.
Yeah, it's kind of like, Mortal Kombat and Pit Fighter is probably...
Yeah, you know, they use the digitized people and the CG backgrounds.
Ugh.
But it's... much, much worse than any Mortal Kombat game. So, John, I think you have a pretty good recollection of the characters. Why don't you give a rundown, and I'll just provide some commentary.
When you choose your character,
yeah,
all the pictures are actually real pictures of real people.
Well, real's a tough word here.
Well, I mean, they are actual pictures. I mean, yeah. They actually got real people, real actors dressed up in costumes. They took pictures of them and put them in the game.
You're making me hope that somewhere along the line you found Street Fighter the movie the game. Because the thrill of playing with Ginger Van Damme as All-American Guile is something that I've always craved.
This is a different kind of horror. But we'll get to something closer to what you want in a minute.
Yes.
Well, first off, you have to realize that every character in this game covers an archetype, or rather a stereotype.
Yeah.
This is nothing new for fighting games.
No.
But this is particularly
egregious.
I mean, you have characters, for example, you have a character named The Dragon, and he looks like Bruce Lee.
Yep.
And he practices Kung Fu.
Yep.
That's what, you know, I mean, pretty much straight down the middle.
What about Crimson Flood or whatever her name was?
Crimson Glory, who was a biker chick.
A biker chick, yes.
Yeah. When she actually beat you, she pulled out a bottle of alcohol of some sort.
It was a very flammable type of alcohol.
Yes, and she takes a drink of it and spits it up into the air.
Yeah, like a cloud.
Yes. And then there was also Shaky Jake.
Shaky Jake?
Who is some sort of swamp man.
Let's discuss Shaky Jake for a minute.
Let's talk about Shaky Jake.
Shaky Jake's wearing a poncho.
Yep.
He's got, not like a cowboy hat, like a Crocodile Dundee hat on.
He's an alligator hunter, I would imagine.
He's got the walking sticks. I thought he was on Walkabout, but based on
he could very well be.
Based on his font,
Walkabout.
But his font looks exactly like the Van Halen font, which makes me think maybe they meant to make a roadie on Walkabout during the Van Halen Australian tour. I don't know, but Shaky Jake is special. John, don't you describe what Shaky Jake does after he wins matches?
Well, after he wins, so you would think that, you know, because he effectively has this bow stick with him, right? So,
which is really unfair because everybody else except for one character is unarmed.
You know, you would expect him to, I don't know, do some kind of pose or something like that, but no. When he wins, he does a backflip. This is not a character that in any way is...
He looks overweight.
He does a backflip. And I was like, wait a minute. Did that guy just do a backflip when I beat you?
So I threw the second round so we could see it again. But he doesn't give you the two backflips. You have to earn the backflip. Instead, he takes his hat off, extends his arm, and then flips his hat down his arm and catches it.
Yep. Like Michael Jackson style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Shaky Jake is pretty much the devil. Is there another character we're speaking of? I think we've gone through the worst.
Oh yeah. Oh no. There's one more. There's the Guile ripoff known as Major Gaines.
Oh yes.
Major Gaines.
He's a member of the SAS.
Yeah, and strangely, he actually has two heights. He's the man with two heights. He's 5'10", but he's also 7'3" or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And so.
The shorter one is his real height, and then his taller height is for when he's standing next to Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, I see.
Ask Hulk Hogan. He knows. He's got experience.
Because I pointed it out. I'm like, John, what the hell does that mean? And then we got Major Gaines into a round because, first off, he looks all ripped in his picture. Like, he looks like he's from the action shot of Street Fighter the movie. But
yes.
But when you actually get him in there, first off, he's pretty shrimpy. Secondly, he's not wearing a shirt.
Yep.
And thirdly, his height randomly changes.
Are you kidding?
No.
He just gets really, really big, and then he gets really, well, normal-sized, I guess.
But, like, halfway through an animation, he'll get, like, 1.5 times size, then shrink back down to normal size.
Yep. What the fuck? I wonder if they couldn't get that actor for the whole day, so they had to bring in a different guy to complete the photo capture for the animations.
I don't know.
So they ended up
using
both actors and just kind of splicing them together.
He's the only character that does it, and like it was really predictable. Like it would happen all the time. It's like, oh, he's big again, and now he's small.
That is super strange.
Now, James, explain some of the arenas, if you will.
Like roof and and bridge and pit.
Throne room, I believe, is one of them as well.
Throne room. Throne room gets two words. In fact, it gets more than one syllable. But let's speak of pit, because pit is special. Pit is not really a pit. But it's like a vault. It's like a metal walls everywhere and lava coming out of the floor. And you're standing on these platforms that stretch from one end to the other. And as John likes to point out, there are fans fanning the lava.
Yeah, for some reason, there's fans. I don't know. Apparently, the heat has to get out somehow, but the fans are actually blowing into the room, so it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It's just cooling off the lava. It's just hot down there.
I think they're using the geothermal energy from the lava to turn those turbines and generate clean electricity.
Of course.
There's nothing...
Of course they are. I didn't even consider that, but obviously eco-friendly.
So John and I play around there. Nothing particularly special happens. We go there again because it's a pain in the ass to change stages, because if you change stage, you have like a second and a half delay between you pressing next while it loads up the image for that stage, because this is awesome technology. So we play another round there, and then I take a couple steps back, and all of a sudden lava just explodes from behind me as I fall into this pit of lava that you couldn't do before. And then all of a sudden a burned out skeleton with one eyeball sticking in comes screaming to the front of the screen, and I'm announced that I lost with a fatality.
Did he say, "Toasty"?
No, he didn't.
No, he said, "I hate you."
but there's just like, all that's left is one eyeball just hanging out of this. It's a particularly gruesome image, actually. But
yeah, it actually is.
It's mature.
Well, what we determined is that in the third round, in that particular stage, this is the only stage we saw it do this in, if you step backwards, you fall into lava. There's no warning this is going to happen. It just...
Yep, you just disappear.
Speaking briefly of the controls.
Oh,
they're
atrocious.
they're the worst fighting controls I've ever played, and yet they are the best 3DO controls we played.
Yeah, I think, I mean, control on the 3DO just in general of all the games we played was just terrible.
It uses the direction disc like the Genesis did, but it was square. Which is weird.
Yeah, and also the start button is actually kind of confusing. It's kind of confusing because this thing, remember, this thing was kind of being sold as a media player.
Yep.
The VCD player, more specifically.
Yeah, there you go.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, and also music CDs.
Yep, so the start button is actually...
play, pause, yes.
Yeah, play and pause, and then select is...
Stop.
Yep. So you look at the controller and you're like, where's select and start? What?
But isn't that sort of the same with the PlayStation controller now?
They're shaped that way, but they say start and select, but they're shaped that way.
These were actually labeled as play, pause, and stop.
Oh, I see.
Yep. So this becomes an issue in our next game.
Well, hold on. They're actually, I don't know if we ever talked about this, but there actually is an interesting story behind this game. Because this game was created by none other than Naughty Dog.
What?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. It was at the time that this game was made, they were practically bankrupt. They had no money whatsoever.
And they survived?
They had no money to finish the game. So what they were actually doing, they couldn't afford a blue screen or any kind of thing like that. So what they did is they filmed all of the characters in their apartments.
Oh my God.
Yep. They basically put a sheet to a wall, and they filmed all of the characters like in their apartments. And they said that the apartment turned out to be too small, so to film moves in the game, they had to open the front door and shoot from the hallway. And apparently, other people that lived near them thought that they were filming pornos, which would make perfect sense, right? Because you'd have these characters and like, you know, with their shirts off and stuff like that, and like, you know,
grunting,
girls and skippy,
presumably,
yeah,
Crimson Glory.
So this was, this was effectively a do-it-yourself game.
Yeah. And it shows.
From the creators of Uncharted 3.
Yes.
Way of the Warrior.
But yeah, definitely, if you ever have a chance to play it, play it. It's an experience, that's for sure.
Yeah, you can get it to two-player, even though the game tries to hide that feature from you. But let's talk about the play-pause, because that becomes, and the idea that games become movies become games, because this sort of goes into our next game.
Yeah.
John, why don't you go ahead and introduce our next game?
So then we moved on to the coup de grace, which was Demolition Man.
Oh, yeah. John Spartan.
Yeah.
Simon Phoenix.
Oh, Greg, I wish you were there. I wish you were there when they played this.
Of course, a classic film, Stallone Snipes.
Yeah, it features the words of Schwarzenegger administration, so it gets major points.
So when John brought over the Demolition Man box, I looked at him like he had eight heads. I'm like, you, what?
I guess I'm the one that actually rented it, right?
We both knew it was there, and we both acknowledged that it was something that had to be touched, but I think you brought it over.
Yeah.
John, did you say, I am the gatekeeper, or are you the keymaster? Must have been what it felt like.
Yes.
But when you, I was reading the back of the box, and it's babbling on about how blending movie and game in a way that you can't see the difference. So what this actually means, if you're not familiar with the story of Demolition Man 3DO, is that they actually got John Spartan himself to shoot scenes for the game.
Meaning Sylvester Stallone.
Yes, Sylvester Stallone in some extremely cheesy, so... Like, pretty much the way the game breaks down is there's shooting. Well, there's actually three different types
of gameplay. There's like eight game modes.
Yeah, it's like there's three different types of gameplay. The first is a shooting area, sort of like Operation Wolf or something like that.
Target Terror.
The whole thing is very Disaster Day of Crisis. Like, we don't actually have a good game here, so let's put together like four different gameplay styles that don't mesh together at all.
Well, the first is a highly pixelated video from the movie. That if you try to skip it, well, we thought we kept crashing the game when we tried to skip it. We'd hit the start button.
Yeah, because it would freeze, right? Because the screen would freeze.
We hit start, and the game just freezes, and we're like, all right, we have to watch a stupid video every time. Fine.
Yeah.
But we realized, no, that play pause button is actually doing what it says. It's pausing the video.
Yeah, it has nothing on screen whatsoever to tell you that the video is paused. It just stops.
So we reset the 3DO like five times to figure out why it kept freezing.
Yeah. Yeah, we thought that it was just crashing. You know, hey, it's an old console, right? So
sadly, that was the most fun they had with Demolition Man.
Oh no, it gets weirder. So it's the opening of the game, the initial conflict with the Snipes character.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to this other video that's clearly shot with a different kind of camera. And actually, that background looks like it's bad CG, but that's Sylvester Stallone running around with his gun pressed to his face.
Yes.
Oh, he's green screening this. Awesome! So they cut in these videos of Stallone running around, pointing his gun like he's a 5-year-old playing laser tag for the first time. And just set to these ridiculously terrible backgrounds. Like, they're trying to blend it with the movie as if we won't notice.
And it's just him, right? There's no other...
It's just him. There's never anyone else in those videos. Right. It's just him. But it's not even shot in the same aspect ratio as the movie clips. I mean, it's ridiculous. But he runs around. He, like, points his gun at some boxes. And then all of a sudden, you're in this shooting mode where you have to drag a cursor around the screen slowly as crap.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, too, it's the way it's tweaked, it's like you always seem to – you'll drag it to one spot on the screen, and it'll go too far, so you have to bring it back. So you're constantly fighting the controls and having to readjust.
While you're being shot at.
So far, this sounds like several individually bad Mega CD games assembled into one spectacularly bad 3DO game.
And the beauty of it is they're popping out from a still image of a soundstage, these really terrible-looking characters that are, again, pixelated images walking across your screen that just are offensive in and of themselves. There's at least one racial stereotype.
Yep. Again, it is a light gun game. What do you expect?
But there's only like three characters in the entire game, so you're constantly seeing the same three guys over and over again. And in fact, on a couple instances, you are seeing the same guy at the same time in two different places.
Okay, and so the other parts of the game are, you know, there's four. There's also driving areas.
Oh God, I forgot about that. Oh
yeah, there's driving areas, and then there's fighting, kind of like a Mortal Kombat-ish fighting, which is terrible again because of the 3DO controls. And then the other one is
the first person shooter thing.
Yeah, there's like a first person hallway crawling kind of thing.
And the hilarious thing to me in watching it is that it had this bizarre effect where every time you turned, the entire display rotated a little bit as if your head was cocking to the side as you pulled your shoulders around. And I thought, it looks weirdly sophisticated and kind of realistic in a way. Like it mimics more of what your head actually does if you're walking forward and you suddenly turn 90 degrees. But watching it over and over, I started to get a little bit queasy, actually, because you get the sense that you're on a boat in the middle of the ocean, you know?
It's the little details that make it work.
It's constantly rocking side to side. And I thought, oh, that's why games don't actually do this anymore.
So we actually couldn't clear the second light gun area. I took two shots at it. Carly took a few shots at it. John took multiple shots at it.
And then your knight in shining armor showed up.
A shining hat. So, John, you interacted with him more, mostly because I actively didn't.
Yeah, so I'm sitting there playing, right? And I'm really not doing very well, you know. I'm just kind of, you know, I'm almost beating light gun-ish areas. And so, you know, a guy sits down beside me. I think he was playing Astro Warrior.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was playing this Sega Master System game that was clearly the inspiration for Star Prince and Retro Game Challenge. Looked exactly like it.
So, and so, you know, he looks over and he's just kind of, you know, checking me out, you know, watching me play.
Well, we were all checking you out, John. I mean, those pants were just way too tight.
There was a crowd watching Demolition Man at this point.
Yeah. I mean, because that's the thing. This is the kind of game that looks just so terrible that it draws a crowd. So, you know. And so, you know, of course, James and I, we're just howling at this game, right? Like, we're just laughing and laughing. And so, you know, if you walk by, you couldn't help but just kind of see what we were doing. And so he looks over and he's like, I see you've selected Demolition Man. And so I said, yeah, we're just playing 3DO. We've never really played it before. It's, you know, it's pretty bad. And he's like, man, I've played way too much of this game. I'm like, oh, really?
John said, me too.
Because that's the thing, you have to understand this game is so obscure, and the 3DO itself is so obscure, right?
But first off, let me say you're underselling how he did the I see you selected Demolition Man. Like, it was Yes. It was very knowing and slightly chilling. I mean, there
Yes.
Like, I started to move at this point.
He's like the pet shop owner in Gremlins, you know, like stroking his chin. Oh, what have you got there?
Yeah. And so, like, I had no idea really what I was in for. But, you know, so I'm playing the light gun part, and I wasn't really doing that well at all because, you know, I didn't really know the tricks of the trade, as it were. And so he slowly just kind of, you know, he watches me play, scopes out my game, sees what I'm doing, and he's like, you know, why don't you shoot make sure you take that guy up there. Make sure you take him out first. And so I take him out, right? It helps. And he's like, yeah, shoot that oil can over there. You know, and he's like telling me, he's giving me all these hints and tips. And I'm like, what the hell? How does this guy know all this stuff about this game? You know, he's telling me like how to switch over to auto fire and, you know, how to get more ammo and, you know, how to get, you know, an extra life. But I mean, not just like, oh, this is the kind of thing that you shoot. He's like, no, like literally
shoot that specific pixel.
But in order as well. Like, okay, yeah. First shoot that, then shoot that, then shoot that guy over there, then shoot that guy over there. And I'm like, who in the fuck is this guy?
Keep in mind that we had believed up until that moment that the order in which the enemies come out was random.
Yeah. No, I mean, it totally wasn't. I mean, he had the whole thing mapped out. And eventually what I started to do is because the controls were so terrible in these Mortal Kombat style areas that I just started handing the controller over to him because he was so good at it. He was like a savant. I mean, like, I couldn't even approach his skills in this game. And so, but to top it all off, we actually didn't beat the game. We got close. We got to the, I think.
You got closer than anyone has in the past 15 years. I'll tell you that.
No, this guy probably went home and finished the game himself later.
But see, the first maze area, he explains it to me. He's like, okay, well, this next area is going to be in a maze. I mean, this guy was like my guru, you know? He was like on top of the mountain giving me pearls of wisdom. And so he says, okay, in this next area, he says, the best way that I can explain it is that you're going to be in this maze and there's going to be pipes and you'll just have to find your way out. That's the best I can do. And so I was like, okay, well, this is going to go great. You know, I'm thinking, Christ, this is going to be a debacle. So, okay, so we get in this. It's just a terrible, you know, pixelated 3D kind of cave. It's kind of like
everything looks the same.
Yeah, it's like this underground tunnel that you're trying to find your way out of, right? So, and it was just unbelievable because bear in mind, this guy probably hasn't played this game in years, but apparently he played the hell of it when he was a kid. So so we get in there and he's like, okay, go straight, go along. You know, we go along a little bit and we see a pipe. He's like, okay, take a left. Okay, so I go along. He's like, okay, hold on, stop, turn left. No, turn right. Okay, go right, okay, go. And seriously, this went on for like 10 minutes.
It went on for, I walked away and came back and they were still going.
It was like this like Zen sort of experience where like it was just a collective blackout where it's like I just, you know, was just like this mind meld with the controller, with his voice, his disembodied head just hanging over my shoulder. Right, left, go straight. And it was just finally, we get to the end and it's like this red door that you just walk up to and that's the end. He's like, oh my God, I can't believe that. He's like, I did that completely. He's like, I haven't played this game for years, but I knew everything. And I mean, literally, he just directed me all the way to it. Like, you know, and I would shoot the guards as they came up, but I did nothing. I just followed his directions and he directed me right to the end. It was ridiculous. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. This guy was like, oh my God. And we almost did it in the other maze. But I got killed, I think, right before the exit.
Oh, so I had actually been over at the wall charging up my 3DS, and I heard them hit the door, and I'm like, oh.
Well, everybody left. I mean, Johnny was like, fuck this shit, I'm playing Vectrex. So Johnny was out of there. I mean, seriously, we were there for probably...
Well, see, here's how amazingly hypnotized John was. The Vectrex was literally 4 feet from the 3DO. He didn't even realize. He's just so enraptured by this maze.
Like, James left, Carly left, Johnny left, everybody left. They're just like, okay, well, they're not going anywhere for a while.
Well, because the maze part was so boring looking. I mean, just walking through darkness. There's the old Windows 95.
Oh, the screensaver?
Oh, yeah. That was what I was thinking of when I was watching it, but way uglier.
Yeah, so what happened was the next, I think before the Retronauts panel, actually, you know, when we were waiting.
Yeah, so it was just you, me, and Carly.
Yep. And so Johnny, you had already left, but I actually ran into him. They actually sat him down right beside us.
Yes.
And I'm like, hey, man, what's going on? And so, you know, we were laughing, and I guess the story, because I asked him how many games he had for 3DO, and he said that he had not including ones that he couldn't find in the stores and that he had like, you know, ripped online or whatever. He said that he had like retail copies. He had like 60 games for the 60 games for the 3DO. And I was like, why and what on earth? What's the story behind that? Because nobody in their right mind that was just a normal person would have 60 3DO games. Like,
keep in mind, this system cost like $600 at the time. It was expensive.
The games were expensive back then, yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, right, he was playing this back in like 96 or mid-90s when it was...
Right. This wasn't a retro collection.
And so I guess the story behind it was that his dad was owned like a stereo store and he was an authorized Panasonic dealer.
Ah.
So he got the 3DO like pretty much right off the bat, and he probably just got a whole bunch of free games because he said that, and it was probably, from what I understand, it was probably a fairly prominent store because, he said that he got to like talk to like the devs and stuff like that were making games for 3DO and all this stuff. So that's why. So he kind of had the hookup for 3DO. So that's why. It's like
a blessing and a curse, but mostly a curse.
This is my third PAX, and that was the surrealist experience I've ever had there.
Yeah. I have nothing more to say about it, man.
Yeah,
amazing.
We got in the car that night, and John, Carly, and I are just giggling about the phrase, I see you picked Demolition Man.
I see you've selected Demolition Man.
Oh, man. All right, so that was a great story. We're going to take a break now. There is more to say about PAX East, and we'll say it when we come back right after this.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
There's been a lot of reviews on NWR over the past couple of weeks. We begin with Alex Calafi's look at Xenoblade Chronicles for the Wii, of course, just came out in North America. He didn't expect to give such a high score to a game he originally knew so little about, but then again, he didn't expect to be playing one of the best RPGs of the past 10 years. So I think he liked that one. Mm. Next up is Neil Ronahan's look at Quetzal's Corridors for the 3DS eShop. Is this sequel to WiiWare Through Space the right game to fit that hole in your 3DS's metaphorical wall?
Let's point out that Quetzal's Corridors, if you want to play a download game this week, it's going to have to be that one because the other one's lowly dress-up sim. Thanks, Nintendo.
I don't speak for yourself.
If I could give DSiWare, I would have gifted you both of the games in that series already.
On the 3DS eShop, we have a review of Colors 3D by Zach Miller. He says, it turns your 3DS into a Wacom tablet. And another 3DS eShop review by James Dawson. It's Arc Style Soccer 3D, which is a character creation app masquerading as a soccer game.
Ouch. That's special right there. I've got dueling 3DS impressions. I have a 3DS eShop impressions of Bomb Monkey by Alex Wanshura, Renegade Kid's follow-up to Mutant Muds. He turned the system on its side for bomb-blasting puzzle gameplay. We also have impressions for Mario Tennis Open by Carmine Red. He says if every sport were Mario Sport, he would add much more fun in PE, I guess. Or he'd be dead because they'd be on fire!
Next up, we've got impressions of the 3DS game Heroes of Ruin by... John Lindemann?
Yes, returning from the dead.
Wow.
Inspired by Demolition Man. He's been on ice for a while, but he's back with bleached hair. Can't go. See him, but it's bleached.
Nice. He's gone Super Saiyan.
They couldn't keep a good man down.
Oh, dear.
John says Square Enix looks to give 3DS dungeon crawlers what they're missing. And finally, we have a blog called My First PAX East by Alex Calafi. We met Alex at the show, and he tells a story filled with love, loss, and too much street passing. I say...
But not enough Demolition Man.
I say there's no such thing as too much street passing.
Or enough Demolition Man. What?
Alright, be sure to head over to NintendoWorldReport.com right now to see all of this great original content and much, much more. Okay, we are back with more talk about PAX East, about actual good games, maybe a couple more bad ones, but not in the level of depth that you heard previously, and talk about something that, you know, we all spent a lot of time on, and that is Street Pass. It seemed like everybody was Street Passing, and I mean, John, I know you were making some observations about the proportion of the systems that was happening at PAX East this year. How many of the people there do you think had a 3DS?
It just seemed like everybody had one. And you know what was interesting about it is I did not see one Vita anywhere.
I saw Neil's, and I might have...
Yeah, but aside from Neil, I mean, in terms of people that we didn't know...
I saw one on the plane on the way there, and I think I saw one on the way back.
Yeah, I saw nobody playing one. But I mean, I would say, I think it would be safe to say that about every third person had a Nintendo 3DS.
Easily.
I mean, it was crazy. I mean, if you were in a room, anytime that they like put, cause they put you in kind of these holding pens for some of the bigger panels and, mm-hmm. you know, you're in there with maybe 50 people. And I would say at least half of the room at any given time would have a Nintendo 3DS. I mean, it was just street passing was just insane.
Yeah. I ended up with over 1,000 street passes total. That's including E3 last year as well. But
yeah, I mean, I went into the show with, I think probably about 30 street passes, just like every once in a while I would get one here and there. I walked out of the show with 700.
It really can start to feel like work after a while, clearing them out, because it only holds 10 at a time, at least in the Street Pass Me Plaza. And it takes a few minutes to kind of go through them, collect your puzzle pieces, do the Find Me, and you're holding R down the whole time to kind of fast forward through it. Carly actually taped down the R button on her 3DS.
Yeah.
Which is maybe a smart idea. And it was crazy. I mean, there were times when there would be seven or eight of us in a group. We all knew each other. You know, we're all like waiting for the food trolley, maybe, to go out for lunch. And literally, we're all standing there outside. Every single one of us has a 3DS open doing Street Pass all at the same time. I even got a photo of this because I thought I looked up and realized how ludicrous the whole situation was. But
yeah,
it's so addictive that you almost can't get annoyed by it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was just amazing. I mean, I hadn't done any Street Pass, any of the mini games at all, like Find Me or any of that stuff, really. I had only about half of the Metroid panel completed when I started the show. I finished all the panels. Find Me, both quests.
Yeah.
And I think I'm at the very end of Find Me 2, the first run through.
Yeah. Yeah. And I ended up going through Find Me 2 about 3 times over the course of the show.
Yeah.
You can actually go through it many more times than that and keep getting stuff. They made it to so that it's almost impossible to completely finish it. So, which is good because it means you can kind of street pass forever.
Yeah. In fact, Find Me 2, when you beat it the first time, which I did there, unlocks this Find Me 2 secret path,
right,
which you have to clear twice, and Find Me 2 regular twice. And there's extra paths in there that even if you clear them twice...
There's a secret key.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff involved.
But yeah, by the time the show ended, I was pretty burnt out on it.
Right, yeah, me too.
Because you kind of become a slave to Street Pass because, you know, you'll clear out 10 and you'll do the, you know, you'll kind of cash them in on the mini games, and then as you're clearing them out, more are coming in. So right. You're sitting there playing through Find Me, and the little green button is flashing already on your 3DS.
And you go, huh.
Yeah, and they would just, and it was funny because the way they kind of march up, only one marches up at first.
Right.
And then yes. you're thinking, oh, it's awesome, awesome. I just have to do this with just one me. And then all of a sudden, there's that slight pause, and then all other 9 of them, you know, walk up behind, and you're like, oh, God.
Well, the interesting thing about this PAX East, I think, is that for me, and I didn't go to GDC, that would have been the other you know, the last big Street Pass gathering in America. But for me, this was the first time that I've gotten to do a lot of Street Pass where I actually had actual games that support Street Pass that are worth messing around with. So it wasn't just Find Me and trading puzzle pieces. It was collecting tons of, I've got so many gems in Kid Icarus that I actually can't hold anymore. And I had to go through and start selling off a bunch of crappy weapons so that I could open up spaces and get more. And I love the way Kid Icarus does it because you just turn the game on and there's a little icon down in the corner of literally the title screen that lets you collect your street passes and clear out that queue. So if you're in a situation where you're getting a lot of street passes, you can do it very, very quickly and it holds up to 50. But even still, you can dump them all out in less than 30 seconds and then start collecting more. So it's much quicker to go through than Find Me or the other stuff at the plaza. There's Freaky Forms, which is amazing. I now have the most insane, ridiculous Freaky Forms you can imagine. And James, I know you have something to say about Freaky Forms because you didn't have it before the show. And I was starting to show you the insane crap I was getting from other people and you had to download it.
And my thought on the matter is I'm still reasonably certain the people who made this game should probably be fired.
Or arrested.
Well, and not or. Yeah. One and then the other. But it's bizarre.
Yeah, I could never actually, like, as someone who observed James get all this crazy shit over the course of the show, I could never actually figure out what the game was actually doing.
Nothing. It doesn't do anything. It's barely a game.
I remember, James, I specifically asked you several times, what the hell is that game about? And you were just like, I don't even know. It doesn't even matter.
It's about making insane, funny creatures. That's all it is. It's Spore Creature Creator. There's a little 2D platformer that is you control the touch screen that's horrible. It's the part where you play Freaky Forms is really bad, but the part where you make creatures is really awesome. It's a very easy to use editor, and no matter what you make, no matter how simple or basic you try to make it, it will look grotesque and funny when you're done with it. And I'm amazed that anyone can sort of make a deliberate design in Freaky Forms. Like,
and yet they did.
It was the same thing as the Miis. You know, once you started going through the Mii parade, you know, on the Wii, and you started to see, like, Darth Vader. How the hell did somebody make Darth Vader in the Mii editor? Freaky Forms is exactly the same thing. I started to get the most amazing creations from people, and my all-time favorite, and I will cherish this for the life of my 3DS, someone made a cartoon figure of Satoru Iwata that is strikingly accurate, like immediately identifiable that this is Iwata.
Except he's like doing a plie. I mean, he's standing on his toes. He's got his arm outstretched holding a wobbly Wii remote.
Yes, he's holding a Wii remote straight up in the air. It's so spectacular, and I was cracking up really hard looking at it. So I figured I want to play the game with Iwata and kind of see how he animates. That's when I found out that his eyebrows are actually really, really tiny wings, so you can actually fly around. But when you fly around with Iwata, his eyebrows are like madly fluttering up and down. It's so great. Oh, dude, there is some sick, sick shit in Freaky Forms, and it is definitely one of my most pleasant surprises for the Street Pass experience. Mario Kart, I'm actually kind of disappointed by, because it feels like the stuff that you get over Street Pass is not really very personal, and it takes a really long time. Like, I got a Grand Prix ghost from John. So in order to race against that, I have to play through an entire Grand Prix that takes like 15 minutes. And I don't even know if that's something John has even done in his version of the game. I think it might have just sent me like a random packet of data.
I find that funny because I have probably put about 15 minutes into that game.
Exactly.
Oh, good. He'll get to relive the entire experience.
I mean, Mario Kart is just very suspect the way it does Street Pass. It's not very fulfilling at all. And 3D Land is kind of the same way because it opens up these mystery boxes and it gives you times of other people that you can race against. But, you know, 3D Land only holds 3 Street Passes at a time. And I cleared it out a couple times and I was like, you know what? Why?
It's the only other thing about it is you do get like star coins from it, right?
Yeah, but I don't need those.
I know most people wouldn't, but I guess for people, like, because some of the levels are locked behind a certain amount of star coins, so it's kind of another way to unlock levels if you were struggling to like get the number of star coins required. Sure. But that which in general, I think for most people, is going to be a lot easier to actually do the levels than it is to street pass with people to get extra star coins.
Yeah. Oh, and I forgot the best part about Freaky Forms. So when you set up the street pass, you can kind of customize the pack of data that it's going to send to someone when you street pass with them. So you can pick three of your creatures that you made, but you can also pick three guest creatures that you got from elsewhere. So it provides this way for you to kind of pass along your favorite Freaky Forms that you got from wherever. And so the best Freaky Forms end up getting kind of passed around and spread virally through this way. It's really awesome. And that's how I got some of the most amazing ones that I have. There were, you know, clearly the names of them were in Japanese, you know, and I didn't really street pass with anybody from Japan at PAX East. I know, surprising. It's only on the complete opposite side of the world.
Yeah, I think I got like two.
But these were Freaky Forms that people had gotten probably from GDC or maybe from, you know, various other events and were now passing along to me. They didn't make them. They just help distribute them. So these things have literally gone viral, and some of the best Freaky Forms I got are Japanese, and you know, who knows how many hands they passed through before they got to me. I love that idea. I love the idea that you can kind of spread data that way, and I'd like to see a lot more of that. I mean, this show really kind of stratified the games that do street pass properly and the ones that really just kind of throw it in as a gimmick. You know, they don't really put much thought behind how it's going to be used. So, speaking about actual games that were new at the show, did you guys play anything that you wanted to mention? I mean, we all played Runner 2, didn't we?
Yeah.
I did not. I
mean, Runner 2, I mean, Runner 2 looks nice, but really, it's just Runner.
It is BitTrip Runner with a different graphical shell.
I heard it's got checkpoints, but they're optional.
It does, and they are optional.
I think actually what you, they're gates.
So you can avoid hitting them.
I think you can just jump over them if you don't want to use them.
Yep, you can. You could jump over them and this like arrow pops up and says challenge. And then the guy manning the gate.
Oh yeah.
The guy manning the gate chases you for a little while, and then he jumps off the side. Actually, when I was playing it over at, I played it over at Axis's booth as well, and the guy next to me was complaining, checkpoints ruined this game. I was like, really, dude? Seriously? Did you realize every stage in this game is longer than the longest stage of BitTrip Runner, right? You're aware of this.
Is that true?
So long.
It makes sense since they're putting in checkpoints.
But there is the occasional one in, like, a lot of them are short, but there's one or two in Runner that are pretty long.
Yes.
I would say there was one stage where if I had no problems with it, I still would have gone for probably about 3.5 minutes. And that was in, like, World 1. they have long stages.
Yeah. I thought the music sounded really good, and the controls are exactly the same as before. And
except they're on the 360.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the game's not coming to Wii. And when you look at it, you can understand why. It is really nice graphics, a totally different art style, and it looks really great. It will probably come to Wii U. I think they told us, well, we do have Wii U development kits.
And we're not working on anything else.
They're not confirming it. Yeah, they said we have Wii U development kits, and we're not working on any other games right now. So I'm glad this is coming to Wii U. It'll, you know, hopefully come out very early. I think they said like November, December is when they're planning to put it out. So that's, you know, exactly the right time frame, and hopefully Nintendo's got their shit together, and you can actually download games by at that point. I'm very much looking forward to it. I think it looks awesome. I played a game called Hell Yeah, and Sega's financial woes came up earlier on the episode. Hell Yeah is a game that, you know, I don't know if it's any danger of not coming out. I would hope not. I would imagine the development costs are very, very low, and it's a digital download game, so, you know, that it should be very low publishing costs as well for Sega. But it's made by these guys named Arcado, and Greg, I wonder if that name rings a bell for you.
Big Bang Mini.
Exactly. Yes, they were a DS developer. They made a couple of DS games, including Big Bang Mini, which you really liked a lot.
I did like it.
And from there, they apparently those games did very poorly. Shocking, I know. They sort of scaled back and became an Xbox indie game developer. So they're making games for the woefully undermarketed and obscure Xbox indie platform. And I remembered their name from that, just from scrolling through stuff, because any of the games that had Arcado in the name were really polished looking. I tried a couple of them. A couple of them I thought were neat. I don't think I actually bought any of them, but they stood out for being a lot more professional looking than most of the games on there. And this is their first sort of return to like a real publishing service. This is going to be on Xbox Live Arcade and PSN and Steam and probably Wii U also. That's maybe a little more shaky than Runner 2, but it sounded quite likely that they would like to bring it to Wii U. And Hell Yeah is a pretty amazing game based on the demo that I played. I'm really looking forward to it. I think a lot of our listeners need to have this on their radar. Neil's the one. I have to give Neil Ronahan some credit. He told me I have to go play this because he said it's like Metroidvania mixed with Drill Dozer. And it is exactly that. It is an open world kind of 2D platforming game full of exploration and action. Your character has a jetpack. But the jetpack is also a ring of razor blades around your character that can drill through enemies and through certain parts of the walls to help you find secret areas and stuff like that. Really, really fun to play. The controls are a little bit loose, but they felt like they were done that way intentionally. You know, they kind of wanted it to feel slightly floaty, which I think makes sense with the character. And the story conceit is that you're playing this demonic rabbit who is the prince of darkness. He's Satan's son, I guess. And he has to take revenge on all these creatures in hell. So the entire game takes place in hell. And so everything's on fire all the time. And it all looks totally ridiculous. And you have to go out and assassinate all of these monsters who have seen incriminating photos of him on the internet. The funny thing about it to me was, you know, there's lots of little minor enemies that you just kind of cut right through. But in order to open up gates that let you proceed, you have to seek out a certain number of these monsters who are your sworn enemies who you have to defeat. And when you find one, sometimes they have certain defenses you have to get through, but once you really get into them, you're just kind of running the blade with the R button and you're eating into him. And once his health reaches zero, the way you finally finish him off is you play this like really short, like micro game, like a 2 second thing where you're either mashing the button really fast or, in one of them, there were a weird, really random trivia game came up and I had to answer a trivia question. Whatever you do, it might be a timing event where some, you know, meter is flashing back and forth. You have to push it at the right time, but whatever you do, if you do it well enough, you will successfully assassinate that enemy and it will play out this completely insane, over the top, overly dramatic cutscene, like maybe a 5 second cutscene of you just murdering this enemy in the most grotesque, ridiculous way imaginable. And every single enemy that I ran into had a unique one of these. So they don't repeat, or at least they didn't repeat in the demo. And they're so, so, so crazy. I thought the game was super fun to play. It looks awesome. It's great 2D artwork, really beautiful, very smooth. And the prospect of what the game is and what they're trying to do with the design of it is obviously very, very appealing to me. It's a Metro game with a jetpack, and you play a killer bunny, you know, running through hell. So I think Hell Yeah should be on your radar. It was really, really fun to play. I'm very much looking forward to it. And it's coming out sometime this year. What do you guys want to talk about? John, you want to briefly go over the tournament?
Yeah, because it was brief.
I'm going to say, it can't be much briefer than the actual tournament.
Yeah, I mean, the NHL hockey tournament, pretty much a dismal showing.
Annual tradition for you, it should be said.
What happened last year was I went with Montreal thinking that I could ride Patrick Waugh to the title. That was not the case. I made it to the semifinals. And got beat by a guy playing Pittsburgh. So this year I decided, okay, forget it. Pretty much the best two teams in that game, theoretically, are Pittsburgh and Detroit are two of the best teams. I kind of forgot about Chicago, which is one I didn't think of. But yeah, so I went with Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh, they have a really good offense, but their defense is, and their goaltending is sort of mediocre. So, you know, I played really good defense, but I just could not score on the guy I was playing. So I got beat 5-1, and pretty much I was in there and I was out of there in 10 minutes. So it wasn't even really much of a tournament at all for me. So I'll have to step my game up next year.
Or you could just cheat.
No, not really. The thing is, you can't cheat in that game. That's why it's so great.
Oh, you definitely can. I could definitely make sure that game ends the way when you want it to.
Well, speaking of cheats, the one game I rented from the Classic Gaming Room the entire weekend was Turok Dinosaur Hunter.
They had the original.
Yeah, they had a pretty deep N64 library, and I was going through that, and I really wanted to play something kind of funny and bizarre and obscure, you know, something that you're not going to get on Virtual Console and something I hadn't played in a long time. I thought that would be kind of fun for a group of us to sit around and look at. And Turok just immediately leapt out of the page. So I checked out Turok Dinosaur Hunter, which I have fairly fond memories of, actually. I mean, it was a very early N64 game, but it was probably the first M-rated game on the system and was, in its own bizarre way, graphically impressive at the time, and, you know, had a very infamous control scheme where you use the C buttons to control your movement and you aim with a joystick, which made it feel like you could do really accurate aiming. I can't anymore. I think if that's a skill I used to have, I've completely lost it. It felt bizarre.
Well, obviously that sort of distinguished it from GoldenEye, which default scheme with GoldenEye, you moved with the control stick and it used a shitload of auto aim.
Right.
And there's virtually no auto aim in Turok. It is very precise and, of course, has a, you know, terrible platforming, as everybody knows, and ridiculous.
God. I assume you got nowhere near the lighter levels, which are just wretched.
Actually.
You cheated, of course. You teased that.
Baby. Exactly. Yeah. So I said, John, look up Turok cheats on your phone. And so he found the big cheat. That's what it's called. The big cheat.
It's the one that's like NTH, GTH. I remember the start of that very vaguely. DGDC.
Yeah, that sounds like you're on the right path there. It was this very, very long password that I had to type in with the horrible text soft keyboard built into the game on the N64 controller. So anyway, we finally got the big cheat in, and it basically lets you do anything. It's like a debug menu almost. You know, you can turn on infinite ammo, every weapon, invincibility, you can jump to any level, you can do all this crazy stuff, a lot of weird graphics filters you can activate. So I said, okay, well, let's jump into, an intermediate level and play around with some of these crazy weapons, because that's what Turok was the most famous for, was awesome death animations and awesome weapons that you can use to kill the enemies, and terrible, terrible draw distance. And I remembered the game being a little bit foggy, but... when you see the game through your modern eyes, is really shocking.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, you can see about, within the game's own scale, maybe 10 feet in front of your character at any time. Really. It's remarkable how poor the draw distance is. And there's just this wall of fog everywhere. Yeah. Everywhere you turn, just thick white fog that you cannot see through. There's nothing peeking out of it. It's just fog. It's kind of like that Stephen King movie, The Mist, you know? Something evil's lurking in there, but you're...
Dinosaurs, obviously.
Yeah. We didn't see that many dinosaurs, and I've...
No. He's hunting for dinosaurs. He's just not necessarily finding that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Most of the enemies are humanoid.
It's just like these live and let die guys, you know, with the voodoo stuff coming at you a lot of the time.
There's a lot of that crap, yeah. There aren't enough dinosaurs for my taste in the game. We did kill a few raptors. We shot them with our tech arrows and...
I assume you would have skipped to the T-Rex, you know, if you're using the cheat.
I couldn't find the T-Rex, but we did eventually, we kind of ran around looking at the funny level designs and everything and played with the weapons. And then we jumped to the final boss, who's called the Campaigner.
Yep, the Campaigner.
Boy, the game really breaks down because it's probably the largest single room in the entire game. Like, they wanted to give you a lot of area to move around in this battle, so they made it like a really unusually large arena, you know, that doesn't have fog in it. But because of this, the frame rate dives.
Yeah, especially if you use, because you get that, the ultimate weapon is the Chronoceptor. That fucks it up big time.
Oh boy,
yeah.
It just reduces it to a crawl, you know, and it's really funny. So we had a fun time messing around with Turok. I don't think they had Turok 2 there, or I probably would have popped that in. That's an actually good game.
It's better. I remember the campaign of just looking exactly like Shao Kahn from Mortal Kombat 2. Is that right, or have I just conflated the two in my mind?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and he does this ridiculous like force jump, where he like kind of turns into a blue blur and just sort of jumps 20 feet up in the air and lands somewhere else in the environment. You have to go find him. It's a pretty ridiculous final boss battle, and you know, I don't know how you would beat it without having the cheats turned on. It was it took forever.
There's not that many bosses in the game, and they're not that great when you get them.
Right.
I think the Mantis thing in the middle was probably the best one.
The game was actually worse than I remember. I kind of thought it would be more fun to run around and play in it, and it wore out pretty quickly.
It's just because, I mean, the environment is so limited, you know, like how different they can be because you see so little of them. You know, it's very difficult to achieve things like a sense of scale or place or anything.
Right.
Because you just can't see shit.
It's kind of a mess, but it was fun to kind of go back to it. A game that I would love to talk about is Penny Arcade Adventures Episode 3. So, you know, I talked about a long time ago, I talked about it on the show, the first two episodes that were, I played them on PC. They're also out for like, you know, XBLA and PSN, but they were neat. They were kind of these point and click adventure games, but that also had Japanese RPG battles in them. So it was this weird mashup of genres that I really like. They're very, very funny. They had cool cartoony graphics and had you fighting all these wacky enemies. Remind me of Earthbound in that way, you know, of these really strange characters coming up and wanting to battle you. It had a lot of Nintendo heritage actually in the DNA of the game, and I thought it was super fun, and it was really sad when they cut it off after the second episode. They never finished the story, and they just decided not to make the games anymore. And then last year, right about the time of PAX actually, they announced that they were gonna actually make Episode 3 after all with a different developer. And the best part for me is it's a developer that I had very recently discovered and fallen in love with, Zeboid Games, who made Cthulhu Saves the World and also Breath of Death 7. They were both Xbox indie games, and now they're on Steam. You can get them for like $2. They're super cheap. They're very, very good retro-style RPGs. Breath of Death is an NES-style game, and Cthulhu Saves the World is a 16-bit-style game. And I thought, man, that's awesome. You know, I loved that game. And the fact that they're going to be making the new Penny Arcade is just a perfect fit. And it is. You know, I got to play it. I got to talk to Robert, the guy who's designing the game and writing it along with Tycho from Penny Arcade. And I didn't get to see a lot of the story, unfortunately. I'm sure it's very, very funny. Because these guys are funny even without having Penny Arcade involved. So it's only going to be better now. But the battle mechanics, exactly like Final Fantasy VI, Final Fantasy III. Exactly. They look exactly the same. They play exactly the same. And I thought it looked great. And the crazy thing is, they're actually releasing it through the same channels as Zeboid's previous games. So it'll be out on like Xbox Live Indie Games and Steam and stuff like that. They're going to put it on iOS too. So it's going to be really cheap. They're going to sell for like $3. $3 for a really, really good, really funny 16-bit style RPG with Penny Arcade characters. You can't go wrong. So I really enjoyed it. I'm very excited to play it. And in talking with Robert, also found out that he and I may be the only two fans of Paladin's Quest left in the world. I told him, I asked him about it. I told him, you know, I played this game. It has a really cool mechanic, battle mechanic that I think you would appreciate. And he said, "You're the only other person I've ever met who actually likes that game."
There is another.
Yes, exactly. So that was really cool. And I should probably mention that game is being produced by our friend Jeff Callis, who's been on RFN several times. So you can go check out what he does at Penny Arcade as well. I think it looks awesome. Man, Retro Roadshow. James, I know you really enjoyed this. I think everybody, all of us who went there really enjoyed Chris Kohler's panel, which was making its second annual appearance at PAX East.
Right. And they actually posted it online, so you can go watch it there if you missed it.
Oh, yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent. Because it's a very visual kind of event, right?
Yeah, so basically somebody comes up with a thing of value, and then Kohler and his panelists attempt to put a price on it.
Well, you think it has value. Sometimes it doesn't. It could be a forgery, or it could be something that's really a lot more common than you would expect.
Yeah, but they tend to weed those out a bit before the show, since they've only got an hour. So they had a prototype game, the NES Earthbound.
Oh, yes. Earthbound Zero.
Which had a find name. There was a name for the find, like it was an archaeological discovery of a proto-human. Which John and I thought was hilarious, that yes. They named the find that these two cartridges were found in.
The Jolly Rancher discovery, ah, yes.
Yeah.
Of course, the find was a garage sale.
Yeah, exactly. The Jolly Rancher. I don't even know why it's called that. There's obviously a reason, but I have no idea.
I think Jolly Rancher is probably the internet name of the guy who bought it at the garage sale.
Yeah, I think that was his eBay account when he sold it.
That's so absurd.
It's pretty amazing because the guy pulled it out of
the Jolly Rancher.
Yeah.
When the guy came up to the podium, and they have Frank Cifaldi was there, and he had a webcam, so they were projecting a close-up of it on the screen so that everybody in the audience could see it really well. And this guy pulls out this Jaws box for NES, you know, the whole Jaws game.
LJN.
Yeah. Yeah, you collect conch shells and use them to buy harpoons and stuff. It's really funny. So we're all like, what the hell? But he opens up, of course, you know, Earthbound Zero doesn't have its own box. It was unreleased. So he opens up this Jaws box and pulls out the NES cartridge that says Earthbound on it. And I almost peed my pants. And I was like, my first thought was, is that real? Is that the real thing? Frank Cifaldi proceeds to open up the cartridge and show the board inside to prove that it's a real prototype cartridge of Earthbound.
Yep.
Amazing. Yes. That was a real treat for Nintendo fans in the audience.
Yeah. I mean, there was some really bizarre stuff up there, including attempts by panelists to buy things outright from people who brought them.
Oh, yes.
I'll give you $100 for that right now.
There's the amazing mint copy of Custer's Revenge.
Yes.
It was in this beautiful packaging. Yeah,
there were two copies of Custer's Revenge, to be fair. Or no, there was a box and the copy that were separate.
Yep.
Which is bizarro.
Well, yeah, well, one of the other guys, he happened to bring some other game in a box that was actually a box that was used for Custer's Revenge, like the actual cardboard box that the games were shipped in.
Yeah, but the game itself, as Johnny was starting to say, comes in this, like, velour box that just says Mystique Games, Custer's Revenge on the side.
Swedish Erotica is on that.
Yes, I noticed that. Yeah, Swedish Erotica.
Swedish Erotica, that game should come with a built-in smoking jacket, that's what I said.
It was amazing because it was exactly the kind of packaging you would get in a collector's edition nowadays. Like, it was really nice, lavish packaging for this freaking pornographic Atari 2600 game.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It was fantastic.
Which, of course, Kohler was just reveling in.
Yeah. Oh, man, it was so good. And then this guy brought up a genuine sealed English copy of Terranigma.
Yeah.
And Chris Kohler, you know, friend of the show, Chris Kohler, like, beside himself, like, couldn't stand to be near it for fear that he might accidentally destroy it with his gaze.
Right.
You know, I mean, this thing is probably worth several $100, if not over $1,000. And it was awesome. I've played a little bit of Terranigma on an emulator. I didn't realize just how rare it is. But apparently the game was released in very small quantities. And of course, being a European, well, the unique thing about it is that it was one of the very few good games ever released in Europe, but not in America, which means there's an English version that Americans never got to play. So this makes it extremely collectible because you open up the whole American market who would love to have that copy. And there really aren't very many copies that were ever made in English. And this one is perfect factory seal, literally in the original wrapper, has never been opened. Pretty wild. I mean, that game is now almost 20 years old. And the fact that it has survived in that condition for so long is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Well, one thing they talked about, I'm trying to remember what game it was. This was during his PowerPoint presentation. But it was this particularly rare, I guess it was an Atari game, that in box like was worth many, many thousands of dollars. And apparently a posting for eBay had one come up. And what you could tell in the background of the picture was that there were many other copies of this game under the one that they were selling because somebody had found a crate of them.
Yeah.
And basically torpedoed the value of the game. Whereas if he had let them leech out one at a time, you probably would have made many thousands more dollars.
Yeah.
But basically, the premise was, yeah, it could be really valuable now and worthless in a few months.
Yeah, you never know when somebody finds this weird, forgotten stash of these games in perfect condition that no one knew existed, and all of a sudden, they're pretty easy to find.
And in fact, they're in better condition than any of the ones that were in circulation, because they've just been sitting in a box.
Yeah.
But they brought out one of the Nintendo tabletop arcade units, which hurt me.
That was really cool. It was the Game & Watch, but it had this ridiculous sort of a natural light projection screen. So it had this,
yep.
It has this thing on the, it looks like a little miniature TV, but it's really kind of just a plastic box. And it has this screen on the top that allows light in, and the light actually is used to, you know, light up the screen that you're looking at.
Yeah, so I was upset because I had actually tried to procure one of those a few different times and have been thwarted individually. But it was a traumatic experience for me because I realized
it cost you about $100 to get one.
Yeah, I undershot the value, so I should have just gone for it at that time. But the last one I missed at 90. And I was like, you know, it's funny because Kohler posted on Twitter his haul from the show floor. Of just random crap he bought, and he just covered his hotel bed and stuff. But I went down there on Sunday. I avoided the show floor on Saturday, because Saturday is just a mess at PAX.
It is.
Sunday was pretty quiet.
We were at the show for 16 hours on Saturday.
Yeah.
And like 14 on Friday. I mean, we were there forever.
It was interesting to compare. It's always interesting to me to compare PAX and E3, because they are so different. They have a lot of things in common. Including the people, you know, there's people who I see at both. So they feel related somehow, but the nature of the events is so different. And this year, one thing that kept coming up is we were so exhausted every day at PAX, even though, you know, it's not like we were working. We weren't,
right.
You know, a lot of the time of the day, we're kind of sitting around playing games and just talking with each other and just, you know, kind of having a very relaxed time. And somebody pointed out, we've been here for 16 hours. That's why we're so tired. And if you look at E3, it's so condensed. The show floor at E3 may only be open for 7 hours that day. But you maybe have press conferences before that, which you're going to have to get up really early for Nintendo's, because that's actually right before E3. And then the show ends at 6 or 7 o'clock, and then you're going to some party or some other press event to do some other stuff afterward, and then you're up writing until midnight, and so it's a, you know, much longer than it actually seems. The other thing is at E3, you're on your feet pretty much all day. So even if it's a relatively short day of 7 or 8 hours, it is really intense. You're walking probably 15 miles over the course of that time. It's very stressful. You're always in a hurry, darting around people constantly. You're holding all this heavy stuff. And at PAX, it's not hard to find a place to sit down at PAX. At E3, there have been times where I probably would have paid somebody $10 to let me sit down in their booth.
It's sort of the drone, because at E3, it's loud. It's very, very loud. But only that 7 hours is properly loud, or 6 hours. And then it's, you know, you're still working, you're still doing stuff, but the sound goes away.
Well, I mean, there's panels that go until midnight, and there's concerts that go until, like, 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
It's still loud at PAX. It's loud, and I think that's what really grinds you down. I think it's just, it wears on your brain so much.
Yep.
Just how much the wall of sound oppresses you. Because basically, you walk in the door till you leave. And we got there on Saturday at 10-something, because we had to get... We haven't told the story about going into the town.
Oh, Charlestown? Nice.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was awesome.
We have to touch on that. But we got there at like 10, and we left at like 1. It was brutal. Do we have time for the town? Because I'm pretty sure this story...
I don't know if it makes a whole lot of sense out of context.
I can make it quick. We had to go pick up some t-shirts for one of the panels, but...
This is the town of Ben Affleck fame.
From the movie, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not the most savory part of New England.
No!
But yeah, this place, I mean, the best way I can describe it is flat out of Grand Theft Auto. I mean, it is, like, the place where we actually went, to this warehouse...
So, well, first off, we tried to find this warehouse on, what was it, on Harbor Road?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're in kind of like this dockside sort of area underneath this massive bridge. It's just a really weird area. It's really out of the way. We really couldn't find it. And it was the kind of place where, you know, if you stop, you keep the car running, right? And you keep you keep your foot on the gas.
And there was no one to be seen anywhere. There were no people in sight, which is probably the creepiest thing for me.
We actually called to ask where it was, and they said, "Oh, there's this bridge. Turn." And we're like, "Turn? Okay." And we get there, sure enough, there's a turn right at the bridge. We turn, and then we're just going past chain link fence on both sides of the road, like it's Area 51 or something.
It looked like a slow motion version of that that chase in The French Connection where Gene Hackman is driving under the bridge. You know, it's really strange.
So we get to this gate that's just closed, and it's like, okay, we have to call to get someone to let us in. So we call, and the gate just opens. No one's there to open it. It just opens, and then. So Carly and I go in, which is dangerous, and we find the door to this printing place, and we open it, and it looks like it's a door from, like...
James, he sends me a text, and it says, "This place looks like it's right out of Bad Dudes." and I was like, thank God you're still alive.
So she opens the door, and it's just this beat-up metal, like, sheet metal door, where she opens it up, and there's just stairs leading up to nothing. And I'm like, oh, shit. So we start going up these stairs, and there's another beat-up metal door, and we open it up, and it's just, like, this warehouse with crap everywhere, and, like, some printers, and, like, a computer sitting on a box that's sitting on another box that's sitting on a table with missing a leg with a box replacing it. And there's just nobody there. We just open the door and it's just nothing. And I'm like, well, there's your shirts. We could just run. We could just go. I mean, we can just get out of here right now. She's like, no, we have to wait. I'm like, do we? Do we really have to wait?
In the back, there was a man playing a 3DO.
In a rainbow hat. But he comes up and he's like, oh, yeah, our accountant's out, so I need to figure out how you guys can pay. I'm like, oh, God, we're going to get killed. And she gives him cash.
Just give me your little finger.
She gives him cash, and we scurry down the stairs. And then we realize we're trapped inside the gate. So... like, we had to walk around for a little while until we found a hole in the fence that we could squeeze through.
Did you really?
It was like there's this tiny gap where the fence stops and then it starts again. And we just passed through there. Because I tried to break the laser that opens the gate and it didn't do anything. I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
We're stuck down here.
And of course, you know, by this time I was just about to, like, you know, step on the gas and get the hell out of there and leave it behind. But I was getting kind of itchy on the trigger, if you know what I'm saying.
As we got in the car, I looked up and realized under this, I don't know, would you say 500-foot-tall bridge?
Yeah. It's a massive bridge.
Yeah, there's a trailer suspended at the top of the bridge, like right under it.
Like some billy goat dude lives underneath the bridge, suspended way up in the air. It was the weirdest fucking thing I've ever seen. Yeah.
What is going on in this place?
When John describes it as being straight out of GTA, that is incredibly accurate. I mean, it's... Oh, my God. It was the weirdest place I've ever been.
It was bizarre.
This is easily the strangest facts we've had so far.
Yeah, this is all to pick up some shirts that Carly had printed to promote a panel that by this point we were missing. But here's the good news. The connectivity panel went on without us and was really good. The part that I saw was really, really good. The audio will be up by the time you hear this. It's going to be on the connectivity feed. So if you're not subscribed, go ahead and do that. It is totally worth listening to. And the video will probably be going up as well. And this was a very audio-visual panel in nature. So that would be a really good one to watch the video for. If you watch the video for our panel, it's just kind of dudes sitting at a table talking to each other. I mean, you probably don't want to watch the entire thing that way. It's really more an audio experience, but the connectivity panel was very visual. It had a great PowerPoint presentation that looked like a Jeopardy board, and they were going through it, and all the questions showed up on the screen. It was very impressive. So they did a great job, and you should definitely check that out if you haven't already heard it before. And again, our panel, the video is already up, and the audios should be on your feed too, in case you haven't heard that yet. So, hope you like it. We had a great time at PAX East. We met a lot of fans, a lot of people from the forums, people who, subscribe to the show. We met some people who heard us for the very first time right then and there. And we actually heard someone subscribing to the show during the panel. So the nice. Theme music started coming up. And I was like, yeah. Oh, okay. You're listening to the show while we do the show. That's okay with me. And we met people who discovered us at last year's panel and have since been subscribers and listened to every episode since then. And now we're making their return to the live RFN experience. So it was just across the board, awesome experiences, awesome people that we got to meet and hang out with. I can note that Pandaradox is evil at Smash Brothers, just horribly, horribly good at that game. And, it was a great thing. You know, I would highly encourage people to try to go to the show next year if you can. Go to PAX Prime. That'll be in, what, September probably?
Something like that.
That's out in Seattle if you're over on that side of the country. I mean, based on our locations, especially for John and James, it's a lot easier to go to Boston. So it's a tradition now at this point too.
It's one of the few cities I can get direct flights to.
So we will definitely plan to be back at PAX East next year. So start planning early, and I hope all of you can come and join us there next year. All right, so that's going to wrap up this episode, and wanted to announce a few things. First off, we didn't get to any listener mail this episode, but we'll probably do it next week. And the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can email us about anything and everything. We'd be happy to talk about it. We love getting emails from people. There's also a link on the show notes for this episode, so you can head over there and click on that to send us an email. We have a retroactive winner. So the poll's been going up for the past couple weeks. It maybe didn't get as much exposure as some of the other ones have, since we didn't do a normal episode last week and we didn't have a thing on the front page. So I apologize for that. I will do a better job next time. But this was our WiiWare poll, and the winner, the game that we are going to play and discuss on the show, is Moto Heroes. Just came out last year, I think. It's from the guys who made Trials HD. It's supposed to be very, very good. It got great reviews. None of us have played it, so it'll be fun to jump into that. So if you want to play along, I hope you will. You know, I'm sure pretty much everybody listening to this has a Wii and has access to WiiWare. So check it out. And, you know, if you've never played a WiiWare game before, it won't hurt you. There's nothing to be afraid of. This is a highly regarded game, so I think this is a pretty safe bet on our parts to jump into Moto Heroes and check it out. And this was probably the most interesting poll in the forum that I've seen for retroactives. A lot of discussion of whether we should even be doing this poll, whether WiiWare is even worthy of the retroactive attention, and people jumping in to defend it. Some people complaining that we never talk about WiiWare on the show. And I said, well, what do you think this poll is all about?
And I have offered to revive my commentary on the download article. I mean,
well, that's
to be fair, this week I could have done it in about 8 seconds.
Yeah, no, I think people want us to actually talk about the games, not just make fun of the press release.
Oh, I talk about them.
But we actually have talked about WiiWare games a lot over the years, but nothing really recently, because they're, you know, it's been pretty thin the past 12, 16 months or so. But Moto Heroes seemed to be one of the shining stars of 2011 on WiiWare, and so we are looking forward to playing that in a couple of weeks. We hope you'll join us. We'll have a really good discussion, and of course you can head over to the website and you'll find the forum thread where you can join the official discussion. We will be selecting excerpts from that forum thread to be read on the show when we discuss the game. So look forward to that. I want to remind everybody that we have RFN shirts for sale. All proceeds do go to help support the podcast and primarily through our host, Nintendo World Report. So they'll support the website as well. I think they're really cool shirts. We're, you know, giving them away and wearing them at PAX East, and people seem to really enjoy it, especially when you see it in person. I think it looks pretty good. And we'll probably have more designs coming up pretty soon as well if you don't like the current one. I think it's great, but I understand some people don't want to wear this giant graphic thing on the front of their shirt.
I don't want faces on my face on people's bodies as a face.
Too bad. It's already out there. But yes, the shirts are on sale now. And go to the show notes for this episode and you'll see a link there. And I hope you will at least go check it out and see if you like the design. Let us know what you think. There is a new episode of Radio Trivia with James Charlton. So that should be a lot of fun. I don't think I've listened to the whole thing yet, but always a good time listening to TYP and his rotating hosts. And I think Greg's going to be on the next episode, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It could be a while before, you know, because it's no small production to make those.
No, they're very complicated editing process for Radio Trivia. But soon, Greg will be on Radio Trivia as well.
That would be the annual event. So I probably will not be on it for at least another year. So
yeah, I always love your episodes, Greg. I think you always have some great, great selections and a lot of fun things to say about the games. And finally, I do want to plug my other podcast. It's called Discover Music Project, and we recently did a show on minimalism, which is a kind of a subgenre of classical music. It's very weird, interesting stuff on there. Kind of cover two or three different composers. There's even a song that I made years ago from using voice samples from Castlevania Aria of Sorrow. So that's how crazy that episode gets. I think it's a really fun episode, and there'll be another one going up pretty soon as well. So you can head over to crosstalk.com to check that out. That's crosstawk.com. And hope you will check that out and let me know what you think of it too. That's kind of my other baby that I work on. That's all, folks. We'll see you next week here on Radio Free Nintendo. Thanks for listening.
Well, right now it says he's not even online, so... Well,
hello?
There we go. Hey!
Hey.
Yeah.
That was weird. Skype said you weren't even being called, then all of a sudden you were there.
This is a fucking disaster. We need to put a cap on this particular file as well. It's getting out of hand.
Right.
Yeah, it's getting big.
Well, let's finish discussing...
Yeah, it's just...
All right, so where was I?
Speed it was up. So good, though. It was so good. It was like, you sound all right now. Skype's been weird tonight. No, I nearly died.
That's awesome.
It's so fucking funny. I've got used to the fucking ironic call quality surveys, but that was a new one.
Yeah, that was awesome.
All right, John, wrap it up.